This is KUAF 91.3 FM in Fayetteville, your NPR station for the past 30 years. And this is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, November 29th, 2015. I'm Christina Karnatz.
I'm Kyle Kellums. Community Creative Center and Walton Art Center present the 2015 Holiday Gift Market, featuring art, pottery, jewelry, and other gift items handcrafted by Northwest Arkansas artists. The gift market is located in the Walton Art Center's Joy Pratt Markham Gallery, now through December 23rd, and open during holiday performances. 571-2706 or communitycreativecenter.org for more information.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, Handmade Moments will be leaving Northwest Arkansas soon, and for quite some time. Before they go, they'll play for us inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio.
First, we begin this edition of Ozarks with a conversation appropriate for this time. Warren St. John is the author of the book Outcast United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference. He spent months in the town of Clarkston, Georgia, where, over time, the once very small traditional southern town became super diverse. Refugees from Asia, Africa, and elsewhere were relocated into the town, many of them escaping horrific conditions like famine and civil war. Suddenly, Clarkston, Georgia was changing, and sometimes the changes were difficult for newcomers and longtime residents alike. Warren St. John became engrossed with one woman, Luma, who had emigrated earlier from Jordan and began coaching boys' soccer teams in the town. He follows the squads as they adjust to America and to Luma's incredibly rigid brand of tough love. His book was this year's selection for One Book, One Community in Fayetteville and at the University of Arkansas. Warren St. John spent a few days lecturing, talking, and discussing the book in Northwest Arkansas. And the annual One Book, One Community Week ends with a gathering of area book clubs at the Fayetteville Public Library. Earlier this month, Warren St. John sat down to talk about the book with me in front of an audience at the library.
When I went down to begin reporting this book, there was a period of probably almost 2 months where I was in a sort of panic state, thinking that I would never get anything. No one really wanted to talk to me. Mayor Sweeney didn't want to talk to me, obviously. Luma is tough and taciturn and doesn't talk a lot anyway. So I wasn't getting a ton there. And the refugee families themselves were, out of experience, extremely wary of anyone who looked like the man, an authority figure of some kind. And here I am with my notebook and my pen and my nosy questions. And I actually called my editor in October. I'd been there since August, and I said, I don't think I'm going to get anything. This is just not working out. And then there was a slow and steady process of kind of, I guess it was just showing up, really. You know, I became someone, they kept seeing me. I didn't go away. And I learned to be respectful. I learned basically not to ask questions for some period of time. And then this sort of breakthrough began to occur probably 2.5 months into my time in Clarkston, where people started to open up. They saw that I was serious about trying to capture their stories and their experience. And then the whole thing flipped around. And I think the best example is Beatrice, the Liberian refugee mom in the book, who didn't really want anything to do with me, and then finally sort of said, all right, you say you want to tell my story, sit down and start writing, because I've got a story and I want people to know it, but I'm only going to tell you if you're serious about hearing the whole thing. And I think this is a kind of a wonderful thing about being a reporter in general, and that is that I think deep down inside, probably 99.99% of people would rather be understood by the people around them than not. And so even people who put up a big front, that to me just signals some vulnerability, not a truly deep desire to, you know, live a pensionesque existence outside of, you know, the mainstream society. People want their stories heard, they want to be understood. And so I've come to realize over time that if you show up with a notebook and a pen, eventually people will talk. But it really took a long time. This is definitely the most challenging reporting assignment I ever had.
When you were there from August to October and you thought you weren't going to get anything, what would you do? did you just literally show up at the practices and just...
I showed up at practice every day. I went to all the games. I visited refugee families and... they would feed me. There was a lot of feeding, just not particularly open up to me. And along the way, and I hope we get a chance to talk about this a little bit later, but I would, in the evenings, drop into houses and into apartments, and a lot of times the parents would not be there. They'd be out working the night shift at the chicken processing plant, and the kids would just be home. And in the case of the Burundian family I write about, they were home with a little tiny baby. And this is before I had any children on my own, but I was deeply concerned about, 13, 14-year-old boys taking care of a brand new baby with no adult around. And then Alex kept trying to burn the apartment down, and that made me really nervous. And so I kept going there in the evenings.
There are towns in Arkansas that have had similar, not the super diversity that we talk about in Clarkston, but Danville, Arkansas, which is in the Arkansas River Valley, Green Forest, Arkansas, which is in Carroll County, have had dramatic population shifts in the last, 10 or 15 years, going from pretty homogenous white to people from other countries coming in to work. And it's been interesting to see how they have dealt with it. This is kind of the new America. And as a grocery store owner finds out, and a gentleman with a traditional church there, you adapt. That's one of the lessons I took from this.
Well, it's an option.
Yes.
And not everyone did. And I think, so my hunch going into this book was that Clarkston was a microcosm of something happening everywhere. And because I'd grown up in Birmingham and spent a lot of time in the South in general, my mother's from Savannah, my father's from a small town of mostly German settlers north of Birmingham. I'd gone from that world to New York and Manhattan and lived in Brooklyn for a while. And then I'd go back home, and I was kind of going between like incredible diversity and culture, this cultural richness to this other thing. And I could see, I guess I could see how, like in certain ways, a very homogeneous setting is so much simpler. It's so much easier. And so I think that there were a lot of people in Clarkston who were, they just wanted the world to be that way. They wanted it to stay simple. And so I saw something in this town that seemed to be happening everywhere. And I'd say that since the book has come out, I've traveled all around the country talking about it quite a bit. I've just had that reinforced. This is something happening everywhere. And it needn't be some refugees, it might just be immigrants. It might be, as in the case of Huntsville, Alabama, where I gave a talk, the big controversy that year was the relocation of some Section 8 housing from one part of town to another part of town. So sometimes the other is just right over there. But all of the same issues are sort of playing out as we're experiencing in Clarkston.
You mentioned that if you show up often enough and you have pen and paper or a recorder, people tell you their lives. That's true, but so many of these lives had so many things happen to them. I mean, when you read of the horrific accounts, the massacres that some of these people escaped and living years in a refugee camp, how would you approach that? And did that ever kind of have an effect on you? Because sometimes they told this in a sort of detached way.
Right. So that was certainly never the... That's never how I start out any of the conversations.
Sure.
And there was a, I think, you have to respect, or I tried very hard to respect boundaries, but there were moments where people would open up about that. And then sometimes there were just these accidental moments where things would come out. And there's a moment with Santino, young Sudanese, kid on the youngest team, and I had a picture of my wife's chihuahua on my phone, and he kept asking to see it, And all the kids in the car were like, you know, hey, Santino, why do you want to see his dog? Why are you so interested? They were sort of laughing and teasing him about it. And he said, well, it sort of reminds me of the dog, of my dog. And we all said, oh, you know, I didn't know you had a dog. And he said, well, I don't have a dog anymore. He's dead. He was killed by the same people who killed my uncle. And then in the car, we're just, you know, all of us very quiet for the next 20 minutes on the way to the game. So there are these little moments where you get a glimpse of something horrific in an otherwise very mundane conversation. And then maybe I would go back around to that and say, you know, do you want to tell me at all about what happened there so that I can understand your experience? I wouldn't do that with Santino, he was too young, but with the adults. And that was another divide I was trying to navigate, is that there are certain things that I felt uncomfortable trying to elicit from children, but the children spoke English much better than the parents, and so there was this negotiation that I had to sort of go through with myself about what I was willing to ask families and in what context.
A couple of many fascinating people in this book, but two I want to ask specifically about. First, Luma, who was, I don't know how to describe her. She's this strong woman who had these convictions, believed in what she was doing, but occasionally we saw the glimpses of her vulnerability. What was she like to be around? Was she just one of the strongest people you've ever met?
She's pretty tough, but also very vulnerable. And I think that's why you see her sort of toggling back and forth. And I think, you know, there are a few moments in the book where she loses her cool. And I thought those were really important to include because she's not a saint. She's a human being. And she's complicated like all of us are complicated. And so I really didn't, and this is the journalist in me, I really had no interest in trying to write some, I didn't want to write the story that fell apart after the book came out. I wanted to write a story that captured the complexity of the town and the people in it and was not a mythologized version of events. And so, you know, that's why I sort of went out of my way to show these human moments where if I was writing the Disney version of this story, I would have just left them out because they were inconvenient. And in fact, those were the things that I felt most obligated to include because I saw them, I knew they were real, and they humanized. And I think the bigger lesson is, or the bigger effect of that is, if Luma is a saint, then we're all off the hook because we're not, right? But if she's just a person who's got complications and flaws like all the rest of us, then it sort of ups the ante on us. What's our excuse? And so I thought that was something I really worked hard to convey in the book was her humanity.
She seems so strong-willed. Right. At times, perhaps stubborn. I think of the time when she was upset with the team and she just wouldn't. She was at a match, they were on the pitch, and she wouldn't even look at them. She was just so disgusted about how they hadn't followed the rules. What was she like with you?
So, you know, we went back and forth a lot. It was a very complicated relationship because I'm not a friend. I'm a reporter. I've got a job to do that's independent of, you know, we have the social relationship because we were around each other. We were at soccer games. We were in a car driving back and forth. We were at dinners constantly in people's homes. But I have a job to do and she's got a job to do. And I think, there was a moment where I got a glimpse that she really understood that, and that was at a game where some of the boys on the older team, the one I don't really write about much in the book, the U17 team, they could drive, so they drove to the game, and they were late. So the game was actually starting, and they run on the field, and she was absolutely livid. I mean, steam was coming out of her ears, and I knew this is going to be a pretty interesting halftime. So I go running over there with my little digital recorder and she just says, no, get away, no. And I was like, Luma, I gotta have this. This is like part of the story. And she just sort of paused and she said, give me that damn thing. How do you turn it on? And I turned it, I hit record, and she threw it down on the ground right at her feet. She said, now leave. And so she was respecting my obligation to capture that moment. She knew that it was important, but she still wanted her zone of privacy to be herself and not feel like she was being scrutinized at that moment by a person. Now, to me, it was a glimpse that she understood my professional obligation to try to get the whole story.
Warren St. John is the author of Outcast United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference. Our conversation was recorded earlier this month at the Fayetteville Public Library as part of the annual One Book, One Community Week at the University of Arkansas and in the city of Fayetteville. And we're going to hear more highlights from that conversation in just a moment on this edition of Ozarks at Large. This is Ozarks at Large. We'll continue listening now to highlights from a conversation recorded earlier this month at the Fayetteville Public Library with Warren St. John, author of Outcast United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference. He was in Northwest Arkansas as part of the annual One Book, One Community Week. His book is about the small town of Clarkston, Georgia, where a super diverse population has developed after refugees from around the world were relocated in the previously small, traditional southern town. He says he's kept up with some of the people he wrote about since the book's publication.
Quite a few. Last night, we were talking at lunch earlier, at my book signing on campus, a student came and presented me with a book to sign that was sort of every writer's dream. It had about 800 post-it notes. Multicolored all around the site. I took a picture of it and I put it on my Facebook page, and of course all my friends liked it, but so did Josiah and Bien and Shem Soon and Nat Nail and some other members of the team. I became particularly close with the Burundian family. They moved to Fort Wayne, Indiana after my reporting, and my wife and I had gotten to know them quite well. We were very worried about what was going to happen to them because they were moving someplace where there really was no safety net at all for refugees. And I knew they needed a lot of academic help or they were just going to get left behind. And so we went on Craigslist and put an ad up for a tutor, found an incredible young woman, and we've sponsored her to work in their home now for 6 years. And she's worked with each of the boys in the family, and now their younger sister. But Bien and Alex are in college. Bien's actually doing a semester abroad in Tanzania, his first trip back to Africa since he left as a refugee. Every time I speak to them on the phone, you know, it's kind of like when I'll go home. I have a one-year-old, and I'll go home from this trip, and he'll be different in just 3 days. And with Alex and Bien, every time I talk to them, if there's a month in between or 2 months, their accent just is like evaporating. Hmm. And they sound just like American college kids. It's really remarkable. And so this morning, when I was checking my Facebook page, I had a notification up high in my newsfeed of Kanu. Kanu just passed his step one in his commercial pilot's license. And all of his photos and Facebook show him with a headset on, you know, flying an airplane. And it's really an amazing journey that he's made from, you know, cooking for his uncle, washing cars with this passion and sense of detail and dedication that was seemed almost beyond his years. And I thought to myself, you know, that's actually the kind of person you want flying your airplane, someone who has his qualities. So it's really a beautiful thing to see.
It would be hypothetical to say that playing soccer saved the lives of these boys, because we don't know what would have happened had it not been there. Am I over-romanticizing if I think Luma is at times a sort of George Bailey character in here's one person who through sheer will decides that we're going to have these teams, we're going to have these boys play soccer, and maybe their lives are better because of it, one person touching so many different ones?
Absolutely. And I think my takeaway there is that, so I think it's indisputable that that's the case. But I think the lesson is, for all of us and for the wider world, not that you have to take on the sense of obligation that she did with this incredible program, but it's little tiny gestures and small efforts can make such a world of difference to people on the cusp of figuring out a new life. Simple example, helping a refugee family understand, a refugee parent understand the power bill before they get their power turned off and their credit damaged. You know, little things that we know are sort of bureaucratic annoyances can, to someone new to our society, seem utterly perplexing. And so, you know, that happened a few times. I remember thinking, like, there was one time when Bien called and said, well, mom's, some guy rear-ended mom's car, and so she can't go to work. And I had to say, well, she has insurance, though. I knew we'd been through all of this. I said, she has car insurance. I said, yeah, she's called them, they're going to fix the car. Well, she needs to call them and tell them to get her a rental car, because she's covered. She's supposed to have another car when she has an accident, specifically so she can drive to work. Wow, we didn't know this. You know, these things that we know, that's the difference between having a job and not having a job, if you can't show up. So there are little things like that that, you know, there are families in Atlanta who would bring groceries once a week or take the kids pick up a family and take them to the doctor for their doctor's appointments. These little things just were almost transformational. And when I was at the Times and it was, we were planning a big immigration series, a little after the time that I'd finished my reporting, we had an expert from the University of Texas who came, and he was trying to sort of quantify, from a data perspective, what could determine, or what were the lead signals for whether or not an immigrant family made it in this country, and was a success in this country. And he had this list of things that he had, through surveys, established. The number one thing was whether or not they gained fluency in English. So if you learn to speak English, you're going to be a lot better off in America. But the second thing was somewhat surprising to me, but made perfect sense. And that was whether or not you made an American friend. And that's because in a lot of these immigrant communities and refugee communities, they're siloed off. They're not really part of America in a certain way. But having someone who's a friend on the outside who can explain the world and help translate not just the language, but the cultural mores, is transformational. So that's a long-winded way of saying you don't have to be a luma to make an extraordinary difference in someone's life.
One thing that haunted me about the book is the lives many of these newcomers to Clarkson, Tennessee had lived. At any moment, whether it's Rwanda or the Democratic Republic of the Congo or some other country, there are atrocities, horrible things going on. And as I read this, and it was a wonderful story, it's just hard to reconcile, and I know I'm with everybody in this room, that these things are happening, and you can feel completely helpless.
To affect them on the other
yes,
side of the world.
Yeah.
Well, it's true, and I think, it is and it isn't. I mean, we make political decisions, you know, every 4 years for president and every 2 years for congressman and 6 years for senators that drive a lot of these decisions. And one of the things that I wanted to make clear in the book and why I went into detail about some of the political difficulty is to show this, you know, that when a refugee fled a town on this day in this year, that wasn't just some random act. It was part of a succession of events that started sometimes years before, sometimes months before, and often that involve us as voters or as a government, and other countries as well. I mean, look at Syria right now. The the world has an effect on what's happening in Syria. When Russia goes in and starts bombing, that affects a new group of people in a new and different way. So refugees, and this is something I really felt strongly about, the when people talk about refugees, there's often this sort of, there's a frequently a failure to acknowledge the degree to which refugees from different places are different from each other and are refugees for different reasons. Refugees, we sort of clump them all together. But refugees from 70 countries are all refugees from, you know, 70 different discrete political realities, some of which we can actually affect in various ways. That's why I went into that level of detail in a few instances in the book, just to show that this was not, this didn't just happen. You know, this wasn't like a tornado or something that just dropped out of the sky. This was
sometimes, you know, centuries old.
Sometimes,
dating back,
yes,
to colonialism, that you could make connect the dots.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Finally, for the radio audience who will hear this later, I will tell you that this audience is not what we would call super diverse in this room. What advice, if you feel like giving advice, can a community do? Can a person, if perhaps sometime in the next year we'll have some Syrian refugees in Northwest Arkansas, there's been discussion of that, what can an individual or a family or a community do to make it better for everybody?
Yeah, I think, and I talked about this a bit last night with the students, there are these pockets in Clarkston where people figured out a way to connect with each other despite the fact that they were incredibly different. And those pockets of connection had a few things in common. And I'm thinking of the Fugees, the grocery store, police department, the Clarkston Baptist Church that became the Clarkston International Bible Church. These were all places where a group of people came together and decided they wanted to achieve something together. Or they really just had a common goal. The Fugees want to win a soccer game. The members of the congregation want to save their church. The grocery store owner wants to, and his refugee employee want to save their store. And it's that kind of common goal that they've settled on that makes everyone's sort of background or differences secondary. You know, who cares where someone's from when you're down two goals in halfway through the second half? You need to score. You need to work together and score. And so there's something about establishing a common goal that to me is way more effective than a diversity workshop where you're sitting around appreciating each other's differences. You know, you're actually working together, and in that context you get to know each other. But even more simply and even in a more basic way, the thing that also animated all of these connections was that somebody took a social risk at some point along the way. Because it can be awkward communicating with people from different cultures. You don't know if you're going to say the right thing. You don't know how they might take it. And it's always easier just to keep within yourself, right? Why take the risk? And yet, in all these cases where the magic happened in Clarkston, someone had taken the risk. So Hong Diep Vo, the young woman who works at Bill Mellinger's grocery store, she's the one who went and said, you know, my people can't get our food here. If you carried our food, maybe I could tell people to shop here and save your store. It took a lot of courage for her to go to her boss, who she didn't really know, who's from a different culture, and say, hey, I've got an idea to save your store. And it took courage for him to say, okay, let's get in a van and drive all the way across town to the other store that sells the kind of food you eat, so I can write down the name of this stuff so I can figure out where I can source it and get it on my shelves. So the social risk really comes down to one thing, and that is when you have an opportunity to speak to someone who is new in your community, take it, say hello. And just, there were the people in Clarkston for whom, there's sort of two views of Clarkston. There were the people who thought it was this terrible place where, you know, awful things had happened and been visited upon them, and there was this change happening that was eroding, you know, the foundation of the town. And there were the other people who thought, wow, this is a fascinating, exciting place to learn and connect. And what was interesting is they were both in the same place. And what version of that place you want to live in is ultimately it's up to you. But the people who really loved it were the ones who spoke to other people and asked them about themselves and wanted to know where they were from and what they were doing and how can I help you and what do you think of it here and have you had barbecue yet and you know all the things that that might seem kind of mundane but that really are the beginning of any real dynamic relationship. It really starts with communication.
Warren St. John, thank you so much for your time and coming to Northwest Arkansas.
Thank you for having me.
Warren St. John is the author of the book Outcasts United, An American Town, A Refugee Team, and One Woman's Quest to Make a Difference. The conversation took place earlier this month in front of an audience at the Fayetteville Public Library as the last event during the annual One Book, One Community Week at the University of Arkansas and throughout the city of Fayetteville. This is Ozarks at Large.
The third annual Ozarks at Large Christmas show will take place Tuesday, December 1st at the Fayetteville Public Library. Musical guests Adam Cox, The Lone Voices, and The Crumbs are scheduled to perform. We'll hear from Becca Martin Brown from the Northwest Arkansas Democrat Gazette, as well as our friends from the Amazium and the Rogers Historical Museum. We'll also be collecting ground coffee, chunky soups, and cereal to donate to Seven Hills Homeless Center. Admission is free and festivities start at 6:30. Hope to see you there.
Anna Horton and Joel Ludford make up the duo Handmade Moments. When we last spoke with them, they had just returned from a tour around the United States and were preparing to spend 6 months in South America, primarily in Argentina and Brazil. They've been back for about 6 months now and have completed their second album. Eye in the Sky will be released next week. And they're almost finished with the renovation of a van, one they will live in, perform on, and drive to South America in about 2 weeks, not to return to Northwest Arkansas for 2 years. Before their journey, the duo joined me inside the Furman Garner Performance Studio to discuss their new work and the upcoming voyage. Anna began by saying how much she loves playing for the Latino culture.
They're more out. People hang out. People go out. People are out. Like, we played our first show in Argentina on our trip out down there, and it was packed. Not because anybody knew who we were. We just showed up. Like, we just asked if we could play that day, and they said yes.
So is it like a cafe, or
where, it was an outside...
outdoor cafe.
It was like an outdoor cafe, yeah. It was like a patio.
It was like a, you know, there's an old town square.
Yeah. And there's like... Well, people ate outside, and yeah, we were just playing for people outside. And we played, like, you know, a few shows out there, and then we played at a real bar, and it was packed. Not because people knew who we were, but because people just go out every night to see live music and to celebrate and have a good time. And if there's a band playing at a place that they are at, they all shut up and listen, and they're all, like, so excited. And then when you're done playing, they freak out, and they clap, and they just go crazy, and it's like... Is this a dream?
A little bit different than here, where people are drinking and socializing.
Talking
and maybe
over.
Not. Yeah.
Yeah. Seems like a big difference in the culture is that we have a lot of technology. So, you know, I don't blame people. I have a, you know, I have an iPad and I zone out on it. So it's really easy to have that as your form of entertainment as opposed to live entertainment.
How has experiencing that culture, how has that, and listening to Latin music, how has that influenced your music and your new album that's coming out?
Well, we did the first album basically just a duo, and we'd have players every once in a while come in. And this album, we rehearsed with a live band, and I think that affected me down south is that bands are... bands are a little bit bigger in a lot of Central American and South American bands. There's percussion sections and things like that. And so I think it affected us in a way to be, I don't know, to try to find a fuller sound with...
A rhythm section.
Rhythm section is a good musician.
Music's so rhythmic down there, like cumbias and all the different kinds of Argentine music. Cumbia is more like Peru, but in Argentina, there's like chacarera and... gato and like all these other kinds of music that are very rhythmically centered.
I mean, we can hear that.
You guys probably,
yeah,
I think so, in the new album.
Definitely. I don't think we tried to, you know, we weren't consciously trying to do anything South or Central American or American. These are songs we've been working on for years, but I think being down there and playing in front of people and playing live a whole bunch helped us tighten up our songs and make them, little bit funkier and a little bit funkier, a little bit more rhythmical, a little more fun, a little more, you know, there's more intention to each part because mm-hmm. we played it a lot and we cut out the slack.
We got a lot of work done down there as far as this album is concerned. We wrote some of these songs on this record in Argentina and finished some down there. Yeah.
Well, you have your instruments. Can you play something for us right now?
Yeah.
This is a kind of a rhythmical, fun song that Anna wrote while we were in South America. So maybe this has some of those South American roots in it.
Vibes.
Every time I fly my kite, I get the feeling that, baby, you still remember, baby, you still remember, baby. Back and forth and from side to side, we romanticize our habit. Why steal it if you have it? Oh, you silly rabbit. And every fall leaves a bruise. I would never try to change it. I'm just that old familiar stranger. But sometimes makes you feel at home. Hippie shakes guiding me again. Oh, sing my sweet Madonna. Tell me what you want. Tell me what you want to. Ferociously the air and flame entangled and love biting. And it's oh so frightening, but it's perfect timing. And every burn leaves a scar. I would never try to change it. I'm just that old familiar stranger. But sometimes it makes you feel at home.
Thank you.
Yeah.
What was the name of that one?
That one's called Familiar Stranger.
All right.
That's a kind of a love song that Anna wrote.
Yeah.
Of sorts.
Love songs.
It was a little bit. I can see the lovey. Yeah.
It's going to be on our new album.
What is the name of the new album?
It's called Eye in the Sky.
Eye in the Sky. All right.
And it's the name of one of the songs on the album, too.
Okay.
Which we just shot a music video for yesterday. And we're finishing on Saturday.
And most of the video deals with kind of makes fun of the drug war in the U.S. And we have friends that have been bused to their house, you know, kicked into by cops with guns.
And our friends, we've had friends that have had cancer.
Friends with cancer that smoke weed.
Gotten guns pointed at them.
And then they get their door kicked in. And
here
assault,
locally?
Here in Fayetteville. Assault rifles stuck, you know, pointed right at them because they're, you know, smoking weed. So just a lot of the video kind of makes fun of the hypocrisy of that, of how much money and energy that we're wasting on a prohibition that is obviously – in its ending years. So most of the video deals with how silly that is and how honestly sad and terrible it is. You know, one of our friends, a girl who has cancer, is in prison right now for having less than a pound of weed on her.
Well, I was going to ask, because your first album did definitely have elements of activism and, you know, political elements to it. So I wanted to ask if you'd left that behind for this second album, but you've shifted gears a little bit, because I think the topics are, that sounds different from the first album.
And we have I think this album's more lighthearted than the last album.
Definitely. Well, just as much activism, but yeah, I'd say so too. We definitely have some love songs on the record, and we have some songs about you know, that kind of stuff, and we have some songs about factory meat farming.
How do you stay connected? I know, Joel, you mentioned that you have an iPad, but how do you stay aware of things like, you know, meat farming and what's going on drug-wise in America while you're on the road?
Documentaries. We watch Democracy Now. Mm-hmm. And being in another country, you get a view of what they perceive of America, like other people's opinions of what America's all about.
How about playing one of the songs that is more politically charged from your new album? Maybe Eye in the Sky, or...
Let's do Eye in the Sky.
Okay. I'll do that one. Never know, never know, never know. He's a cop, dressed in normal clothes. Never say, never say, never say what you really mean, what you really think at the end of the day. And even if you did, would you want everyone to know that he is a cop? In normal clothes. Never turn, never turn, never turn, never turn around. Big booming voice comes yelling at you, yeah, yelling from the clouds. No, baby, don't look back, or you'll be stacked this out for you the rest of your life, the rest of your life. Not bluffing that night. Out the back door. Everybody seems to know what they're coming here for. They seem to know what they're after. No, but there ain't no chicken pot pie. Bad even worse. Go right now. And it's a night in the sky. It's big golden light, and it's coming to find you in a matter of time. And it's the weight of the
girl selling hot dogs and candy. On the 4th of July.
In the sky.
Yeah.
I liked it. I liked it a lot.
Thank you.
Well, since a lot of this album was finalized on the road with just the two of you, but you included in the recording of it other people.
Yeah.
We got some great musicians on the record. We got Melissa Carper playing bass and Rebecca Paddock playing fiddle. And we have Eric Henry playing percussion on some of the album.
And it's all produced and engineered by
Kelly Mulholland.
From Still on the
From
Hill.
Still on the Hill, the best.
Mm-hmm. All local. I mean, local people.
All local cats.
I love having other musicians. And when I'm writing a song, I usually hear rhythms happening in my head, like a rhythm section, a bass player, percussionists of all sorts. So whenever I have a chance to work with people that are willing to, like, make my dream a reality, I'm so stoked.
Traveling on the road, earlier you mentioned this bus that you two have been. Where did this bus come from? You guys are single-handedly remodeling this bus that you're going to. Not single-handedly.
We found this bus a few years ago whenever we were still traveling with Don't Stop Please. So I found this short bus. It was a Chevy diesel out in the woods from this hunter in like Alma, Arkansas, and he had gutted it.
It was awesome.
And he sold it to us for $1,100. And we brought it to Fayetteville up to Billy Lindsay over at Unique Creations. And he checked it out for us, got it fixed up, and he welded a tow hitch on there. And we traveled around as Don't Stop Please.
The new bus we have, the Dream Bus.
It's been painted as well.
Started as a meth camo bus, and we painted, we stripped it of all its paint. We painted it white. We had one of our friends who's a muralist from Argentina who does paintings all over the world came and painted the entire bus, this beautiful mural. We had our friends at Unique Creations build a stage that's welded through the body to the frame. The stage can hold up 15 people. On the stage, we have two solar panels.
It's a big stage on the roof of a van.
Huge.
Yeah.
The two solar panels are going to power all the music. So we won't ever have to plug into any grid at any point. And we also are going to be running the new diesel, Cummins diesel, turbo diesel, on veggie oil and diesel. So
it's a lot.
It's a big project.
It's been a big project.
Once it's through, which we're in the final stretch of it, it's going to be our home on the road. It's going to be our mobile studio.
I was going to ask, you're going to be sleeping on it.
And, yeah, we've been building beds inside.
Awesome.
Yeah.
So we're going to be recording on the road, doing like a video series, probably a vlog, if you will.
Yeah. Well, how about one more song to send us off before you venture off into South America?
Fly away. How about Home Sweet Home again?
Let's do it.
You ready? All right, here it comes, y'all. This is a song I've been working on for the past, like, 5 years, and finally me and Anna finished it, so here we go. Home sweet home again, would you leave in this land? Just excuses and reasons why you can't go. There's a place where
What'd you say to me? Where have you gone? What'd you say to me? Hold me close and swear you go everywhere. When you need a friend, feel me in your hands. Go find a glorious view of the setting sun. Excuses and reasons why you can't go.
Go. Go. Get out of here. Go. Get on now.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Thanks for having us. Yeah.
Anna Horton and Joel Ludford are the duo Handmade Moments. Their second album, Eye in the Sky, will be released next week. They'll have several CD release parties beginning Wednesday, December 2nd at the Whitewater Tavern in Little Rock, Friday, December 4th at the Stone House in Eureka Springs, Saturday, the 5th at Smoke and Barrel in Fayetteville, and Sunday at Zaza's in Conway. And then they're off to Latin America. You can follow their journey at facebook.com/handmademomentsmusic. And this is Ozarks at Large.
Hello, I'm Charity Stillings.
And I'm Mary Lou Gates. We are with Seven Hills Homeless Center in Fayetteville.
This year, KUAF's Giving Tree program will benefit Seven Hills, and we're hoping you can help out.
Drop off your donation at 9 South School in Fayetteville across from the Fayetteville Public Library during the month of December.
For a complete list of needed items for Seven Hills, you can go to KUAF.com or call Pete Hartman at 479-575-7714.
Thank you.
A service of the Walter J. Lemke Department of Journalism and the J. William Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM in Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Springdale, and Elm Springs.
Elm Springs. Okay, tomorrow, the last day of November.
Is it already? I guess it is. 30 days, half
you,
November. There you go.
Every single year. Antoinette Grajeda will join me tomorrow at noon and 7 for a brand new edition of the Daily Ozarks at Large program. You and I will be back together sometime in December.
December 7th, maybe? Is that next Sunday?
Is that it?
I think so.
Okay.
You'll be back
for next weekend?
I'll be back. I'm taking a little trip, but I'll be back.
All right. Ozarks at Large and Weekend Ozarks at Large, productions of KUAF. I'm Kyle Kellums.
I'm Christina Karnatz.
Happy end of November.